The question of human destiny after death is probably one of the most crucial questions we can raise. Nowadays, it's become fashionable to dismiss the question as unimportant. People think that instead of wasting our time over this question, we should turn our attention to the things that are really important in the present life. That we should either try to grasp as much pleasure and enjoyment while we can, or else we should work on improvements in government and society and the economic order and so on. But if we reflect on the extent to which our views influence our actions, we'll see that it's really quite essential to gain some understanding of the complete context in which our lives unfold and not remain content just to live in ignorance. Also, how we view the afterlife will help determine what we regard as important to do now in this present life. If we dismiss the idea of a future life as imaginary, then it will make sense to devote ourselves completely to worldly concerns. On the other hand, if we accept the idea of some life after death, then that will influence our path of conduct, the path that we follow in this life. It will give meaning to the values of renunciation, contemplation, and spiritual exertion. It seems that there are three possible positions that can be taken on human destiny after death. One position, the outlook of materialism, simply denies that there is an afterlife. It holds that the human being, the person, consists essentially of matter, configurations of molecules, cells, and so on. And it says that the mind is just a byproduct of matter. So after death, with the breakup of the physical body, all consciousness comes to an end, the life process is completely extinguished, and nothing remains but the dead matter of the body. A second alternative is that held in the Western theistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, in their orthodox forms. This position is the belief in an eternal afterlife. According to these religions, we live a single life on earth, and then after death, we go on to live eternally in some state of existence determined by our present beliefs and conduct, either in an everlasting heavenly world or else in an eternal hell. Then there is a third view, the view which prevails in the religions of the East, Hinduism and Buddhism. This is the idea of rebirth. According to this view, this present life is only a single link in a chain of lives that goes back into the past and forward into the future. This chain of lives of rebirth is called samsara. The word samsara means literally continuing, wandering on. And it signifies the cycle of birth, growth, aging, and death, repeating itself over and over. Now, both Hinduism and Buddhism share the concept of rebirth, but the Buddhist conception differs somewhat from the Hindu doctrine. The doctrine of rebirth, as understood in Hinduism, involves a permanent soul, a conscious entity, which transmigrates from one body to another. The soul inhabits a given body. Then when life is extinguished in that body, the soul casts that body off and goes on to take on another body. The famous Hindu classic, the Bhagavad Gita, compares this to a man who might take off one suit of clothing. Then after taking that off, he puts on another suit of clothing. Then after wearing that for some time, he throws that off and puts on still another coat. The man remains the same, but the suits of clothing are different. In the same way, the soul remains the same from life to life, but the psychophysical organism it takes on differs from life to life. Now, the Buddhist doctrine of rebirth is somewhat different from this. First of all, the Buddhist term for the rebirth process is in Pali, punabhava, word which means again existence. And Buddhism sees rebirth not as the transmigration of a self-identical soul, a conscious entity, but rather as the repeated occurrence of the process of existence. The word punabhava can be rendered perhaps as repeated becoming, renewed becoming. And there is a continuity, a transmission of influence, a causal link-up between one life and another. But there is no soul, no permanent entity, which transmigrates from one life to the next. The concept of rebirth without a transmigrating soul commonly raises a certain question. This is the question, how can rebirth occur without a soul or self to undergo the process of being reborn? How can we speak of ourselves as having lived past lives if there is no soul, no single self going through these many lives? To understand how this is possible, we first have to understand the nature of individual identity in a single lifetime, how individual identity is possible in one lifetime without a self or a soul. We can approach this by reviewing the Buddhist analysis of what we are, what our individuality consists of. The Buddha explains that what we really are is a functionally unified combination of the five aggregates. The five aggregates fall into two basic types of processes. First, there's the material process, which is a current of material energy. Then there's the mental process, a current of mental happenings, mind and the mental factors. Now, both these currents consist of elements that are subject to momentary arising and passing away. What we call the body, the physical body, is not a single substantial entity, but a combination of many elements, pulsations of matter connected together in lines of transmission, becoming manifest at the material level. The mind also is not a single persisting ego entity enduring through time. The mind is a series, a connected series of mental acts made up of these four aggregates, the four mental aggregates: feelings, perceptions, the mental formations, and consciousness. These mental acts or thought moments are called in Pali cittas. Each citta is an individual act of mind, an act of consciousness, involving the factors of feeling, perception, the mental formations, and consciousness. Each citta arises, persists for a very brief moment performing its function, experiencing the object. Then immediately after that, it breaks up and passes away. When it breaks up and passes away, it doesn't leave any trace of itself behind. It doesn't have any core or any inner essence that remains. But as soon as the citta breaks up and disintegrates, immediately, right afterwards, there arises another citta, another act of mind, which again flashes into existence, experiences its object with awareness, and then passes away. And so it goes on, citta after citta after citta. And thus we find the mind is a succession of cittas, of mental acts, of these momentary acts of consciousness. Now, when each citta falls away, it transmits to its successor whatever impressions have been recorded upon itself, whatever experiences it has undergone, its perception, its emotions, its volitional force, all of these get passed on to the next citta. And thus, all the experiences we undergo, every fleeting thought, sensation, decision, and so on, leaves its imprint on the onward flow of consciousness, on the citta santana, the continuum of mind. And this transmission of influence, this causal continuity, this gives us our continued identity. We remain the same person or being through the whole lifetime because of this continuity, even though there is no ego entity, no self standing underneath the process. Now, the physical organism, the body, and the mental continuum, the stream of cittas, occur in close interconnection. The body provides the physical basis for the succession of cittas, the flow of the mental process. And the mental process rests upon the body as its instrument and basis. But when death comes, the physical body can no longer function as the physical support for consciousness. It can no longer support the cittas, the process of mind. So when the body breaks up at death, the succession of cittas doesn't draw to an end. In the mind of the dying person, there takes place one final thought moment called the death consciousness. This last citta, this last thought moment, signals the complete end of the life. Then following the death consciousness, there occurs another citta, another active mind, the first citta of the new life. And this citta springs up with a new physical organism as its basis, a newly fertilized ovum. This first citta of the new life continues the stream of consciousness which has just passed out of the old deceased body. The stream of consciousness is not a single entity, but a process. And the process continues. The death consciousness in the series is followed by a new moment of consciousness, which arises with the new physical organism as its basis. This first act of consciousness is called the Pratisandhicitta. We mentioned this last time. The relinking consciousness. And it's called the relinking consciousness because it links together the two separate life terms. It belongs to the same continuum. The relinking consciousness inherits all the impressions of past experience undergone in that current of consciousness in the previous life, and also in the many lives before that. In this way, all the impressions recorded and stored up in the mental continuum, in that individual stream of experience, all of these now get transmitted to the first citta of the new life. This first citta, when it passes away, passes the storage of experience on to the second moment, along with its own addition. The second passes it on to the third to the fourth, and so on, from thought moment, citta to citta, all the ways from birth to death. Then, when that life comes to an end, again the stream of cittas will pass on to the next life. And when it passes on, it carries the storage of impressions along with it. And so the entire process will be repeated once more. We can give an illustration how this preservation of identity can take place without any self-identical entity. Suppose we have a candle burning, say, at 8 o'clock. If we come back in an hour at 9 o'clock, we see that the candle is still burning, and we can say that it's still the same candle. And this statement is completely valid from the standpoint of conventional linguistic usage. But if we examine this matter close up, we'll see that at every moment the candle is burning up different particles of wax Every moment it's burning a different section of the wick. Every moment it's consuming different molecules of air, of oxygen. And thus the wax, the wick, and the oxygen being burned are always different from moment to moment. And yet, because the moments of flame link together in a continuum, one moment of flame giving rise to the next, we can still say it's the same flame. But actually, the flame is different from moment to moment because its base, its wick, its fuel, the particles of oxygen, these are all different from moment to moment. And the flame itself is an entirely dependent phenomenon. It's conditioned by the wax, wick, and air, and apart from them, it's really nothing. It's just a derivative of these three placed at a certain temperature. Okay, now we go on to the next step. Suppose the flame reaches the bottom of the candle. We then take a new candle. We put its wick to the flame and catch the flame from the old candle onto the new one. Then the flame on the old candle goes out. So the flame has now been transmitted to the new candle. Is it the same flame or a different flame? From one angle, we can say that it's the same flame. The reason? Because it follows in continuity. It belongs to the same series. But now the flame is burning with a new physical basis, with a new candle as its support. It's burning up new particles of air, new pieces of wax, a new section of wick. We can say it's the same flame as the flame on the old candle because it caught fire from that flame and it continues the succession. But there is no absolute identity of one flame with the other, because there is no condition contributing to that flame that's absolutely identical with the previous condition. It can't be called a different flame. To call it a different flame would do violence to conventional usage. Conventionally, we say it's the same flame, and yet there's no absolute or ultimate identity, because the whole flame is just a process of combustion which goes on differently from moment to moment. Now we can apply the simile to the case of rebirth. The body of the candle is like the physical body of the person. The wick might be compared to the sense faculties that function as the support for the process of consciousness. The particles of oxygen, these are like the sense objects. And the flame, that is like consciousness. Consciousness always arises with the physical body as its support. It always arises through a particular sense faculty, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, or mind. It always has an object, sight, sound, smell, and so forth. The body, the sense faculty, and the object are always changing. And therefore, consciousness with the mental factors are always changing. But because each act of mind, each thought moment, follows in sequence from its predecessors and gives rise to the next, and because the contents of the mind, the set of impressions, tendencies, dispositions, and so on, because these are passed on from one moment to another, we speak about the body-mind compound as being the same person at different times. We say it's the same man, the same woman, and so on. Now, when the body loses its vitality, when death takes place, that is like the first candle coming to an end. The transmission of the flame to the next candle, that is like the passing of the current of consciousness, the mental continuum, on to the next life. Then, when the mental continuum takes up the new body, that is like the flame of the old candle passing on to the new candle. And just as there is the causal transmission of the flame from one candle to the other, so in the same way there is a passing on of mind, the mental process, from one physical body. The Buddha teaches that in order for conception to take place, the presence of this stream of mind, this mental process, is absolutely necessary. Without the mind or mind continuum, there can be no rebirth. The Buddha says that there are three necessary conditions for conception to take place. First of all, there has to be the union of father and mother. The father to provide the sperm, the mother to provide the egg. The second condition is that it must be the mother's proper season. If the mother isn't fertile, conception won't take place. But then the Buddha says there is a third condition. This he calls the Gandhabha. The Gandhabha is the stream of consciousness of the deceased person, the flow of mind that's ready, prepared to take rebirth. And the Buddha says that even though the father and mother have intercourse, and even though it's the mother's fertile season, if the Gandhabha, the appropriate stream of mind, is not present, then conception will not take place. But when all the three conditions are met, when the Gandhabha is present, then conception can take place. The egg will be fertilized, it will form a primary cell, and the new life process will begin. Now, another question comes up. That is there any causal structure behind this process of rebirth? Does it just go on automatically and inevitably? Or is there some set of causes underlying it that sustain it and keep it rolling? The Buddha teaches that there is a distinct set of causes underlying the rebirth process. That the rebirth process has a causal structure. This structure is set out in the teaching of dependent arising, Paticca Samuppada, which we explained in the last talk. But now we will take up this doctrine again and explain it in specific connection with the working of the rebirth process. First of all, in this life, there is present in us the most basic root of all becoming, that is, ignorance, avidya. And because of our ignorance, we perceive things in a distorted way through the perversion. Things appear to us to be permanent, pleasurable, attractive, and to stand in some relation to ourselves, to be a self or the belongings of a self. Because of these distortions, there arises in us craving. Craving for sense pleasures, craving for existence, for sight, sound, smells, tastes, touches, and ideas. Basically, craving hangs on to pleasant feelings. The Buddha says, Vedana Paccaya Tanha, that feeling is the condition for craving. Craving is aroused in our mind by the experience of pleasant feeling, and then we long for the continuation of our pleasant experiences and for their repetition in the future. To obtain pleasant feeling, we require agreeable objects, agreeable sight, sound, smells, tastes, tangibles, and ideas. In order to obtain the pleasure these objects can give, we have to make contact with those objects. That is, we need pasa, contact. And to contact the objects, we need sense organs, sense faculties, that are able to receive the sense impressions, that can function as the instruments of experience. experience. We need, in other words, the six sense faculties, the salayatana, to see forms. We need the eye to hear sounds. We need the ears to smell odors. We need the nose, and so on. To experience touches, we need the body. To experience ideas, we need the brain, nervous system. Now, in order for these six sense faculties to exist, the entire psychophysical organism is required. That is nama-rupa, the mind-body complex. The sense faculties do not operate in disembodied space, but as parts of a total organism. Thus, on account of craving, the mind holds on to this presently existing organism, this nama-rupa, as long as it lives. Why? So it can have the six sense faculties to contact agreeable objects through the senses, in order that it can enjoy the pleasurable feelings that arise from sense contact. As long as life lasts, we continue to hold on to the same psychophysical organism. Now, when death comes, this body ceases to provide a suitable basis for obtaining pleasure through the senses. Because the sense faculties are dependent upon the rest of the body, when life in the body comes to an end, the senses become defunct. They can no longer serve as the media between the mind and the world. But on account of craving, the mind still wants a world. It wants to experience a world of sights, smells, and so on. And to do so, it needs a physical body. This body can no longer support the mind. But if craving still remains, if there is still the drive for pleasure, for more experience, for continued existence, for sight, sound, smells, taste, touches, and ideas, what can be done? The mind process lets go of this body. Then, through the craving for existence, the mind process grasps hold of a new body. Thus, craving causes the stream of mind to spring up again, grasping on to a fertilized egg, lodging itself in that fertilized egg, bringing the whole storage of accumulated impressions over with it into the new psychophysical organism. And thus we see a new being has been conceived. For this reason, the Buddha calls craving the seamstress, sibini. Just as a seamstress sews together different pieces of cloth, so craving sews together one life to another. It ties together the succession of life. Thus samsara, the wandering on in the cycle of existence, is maintained by craving. As long as craving remains, the process goes on. Death is no barrier to the continuation of the process, to the renewal of experience through the six sense faculties. Craving is so powerful that it's able to bridge the gap created by death and to rebuild the whole house of sentient existence again and again, over and over. Now we come to the next question. We see that there's a tremendous variety among the living beings existing in the world. The beings we can see, people and animals, of many different sorts. So we can ask, what is it that causes us to take rebirth in a particular form? Does it all happen through coincidence, through accident, through chance, without any reason? Or is there some principle behind it? What is it that determines the form of rebirth we take? The answer to this question the Buddha gives in the word Pali word karma, in Sanskrit karma. Karma is the factor which determines the specific form our rebirth takes, which determines what kind of a person we are at the outset of our life. And it's karma, again, that determines a good number of the experiences that we undergo in the course of our life. The word karma means literally action, deed, or doing. But in Buddhism, it means specifically volitional action. The reason, because volition is the chief factor in all action. In a sutta, the Buddha says, Chetanaham bhikkave kamang padami. Monks, it is volition that I call karma. And the reason? Because having willed, one then acts through body, speech, or mind. What really lies behind all action, the essence of all action, is volition. Power of the will. And it is this volition expressing itself as action through body, speech, or mind that the Buddha calls karma. And this means that unintentional action is not karma. If we accidentally step on some ants while walking down the street, that is not the karma of taking life, because there is no intention, no volition of taking life. If we speak some statement believing it to be true and it turns out to be false, we're not to blame for the karma of lying, because we have no intention of deceiving or lying. Karma refers exclusively to action that is backed up by volition and that expresses volition. Now, karma manifests itself in three ways, through three channels called the three doors of action. These are body, speech, and mind. When we act physically, the body serves as the instrument for expressing our volition. Thus, the act done with the body is bodily karma, kaya karma. When we speak, expressing our thoughts and intentions verbally, that is verbal karma, which is performed either directly through speech or else indirectly through writing, through hand signs, or other means of communication. Then when we think, plan, desire inwardly without any outer action, that is mental karma, mano karma. Thus, there are three types of karma named according to their channel of expression, the door or faculty through which the volition becomes manifest. But what lies behind all of these forms of action is really the mind, and the chief mental factor that causes the action is the volition. When one person injures another, the means of action is the body. What really inflicts the injury is the volition, the factor of mind. When one person helps another, gives another a helping hand, what is doing the action is the body, but what lies behind the action is the mind of helpfulness. So outward actions are the expressions of volition. For this reason, the Buddha singled out volition as the decisive factor in action. And all volitional action is called karma. People sometimes show their misunderstanding of the concept of karma when they think of the things that happen to them as their karma. That is not their karma. That is the effect or the fruit of their karma. If they meet a lot of trouble, they say, oh, this is my karma. But that isn't their karma. Karma is the active force, the present action. many of the troublesome situations people find themselves in come about because of their past karma, their past actions. And the misery that they now feel over their situation, that is not the result of old karma, though. That is a way of reacting to the present situation. That is a form of action, of present karma. It is a karma rooted in aversion, in ill will, and therefore it's an unwholesome karma which will produce unfavorable effects in the future, which will only perpetuate their trouble. Now, the main standpoint from which Buddhism classifies karma is the ethical standpoint, since it's the ethical quality of action that determines the kind of results it will produce. And the Buddha divides karma right down the middle into two general classes. On one side, he puts unwholesome karma, akusala karma. On the other side, he puts wholesome karma, wholesome action, kusala karma. Unwholesome action, unwholesome karma is action which is spiritually harmful and morally blameworthy. Wholesome karma is the opposite, action which is spiritually beneficial and morally praiseworthy. And the Buddha gives two basic criteria for distinguishing unwholesome and wholesome karmas. One is the intention behind the action. Action which is intended to bring about harm to oneself, to bring harm to others, or to bring harm to both, that is unwholesome karma. On the other hand, karma which conduces to the good of oneself, to the good of others, and to the good of both, that is wholesome karma. So that's the first criterion he gives. The other criterion the Buddha gives for distinguishing unwholesome and wholesome karma is the roots of action. Now, the Buddha teaches that all karma, all action, arises from certain mental factors called roots. These are the causal factors of action, the source, the motivation of action. All unwholesome actions come from three unwholesome roots. These are greed, aversion, and delusion. Greed is selfish desire aimed at personal gratification, expressed as grasping, craving, and attachment. Aversion is ill will, hatred, resentment, anger, a negative evaluation of the object. Then the third unwholesome root is delusion, that is ignorance, mental unclarity, confusion. And any occasion of unwholesome action, the Buddha says, can be traced to one or another of these three roots. On the wholesome side, we also find three roots. These are non-greed, non-aversion, and non-delusion. Non-greed becomes manifest as detachment and generosity. It's the quality of being able to renounce objects of desire, or to give away valuable things to others. The second wholesome root is non-aversion. That is expressed positively as goodwill, as friendliness and loving kindness. The third wholesome root, non-delusion, that is really the same as wisdom, understanding, mental clarity. And any action which is rooted in one or another of these three wholesome roots is a wholesome action, a kusala karma. Because of the great importance of the roots, we have to be very careful how we judge actions, our own and others. Often there can be a sharp difference between the outer action and the mental ground from which that action springs. If we look into our own mind to see the roots of the acts that we pride ourselves on, we might be less elated over our good deeds. And so too for the deeds of others, these might call for a more careful evaluation. We might be doing a lot of good work for others outwardly, but the underlying motive behind our good works might be a desire to gain fame and recognition, a form of the unwholesome root greed, craving for name and fame. Somebody else might be sitting quietly, meditating, seemingly aloof, but inwardly he might be developing a mind of great loving kindness and compassion. People might criticize him as for doing nothing, for seeking only his own good, but he might be doing more to benefit the world than the active do-gooder who's out there driven by desire. Now, there are 10 main forms of unwholesome action called the Dasa Akusala Kamapatta, the 10 courses of unwholesome action. 3 of these are bodily: taking life, taking what doesn't belong to oneself, and engaging in sexual misconduct, adultery, seduction, and so on. 4 of these are verbal: speaking falsehood, speaking slanderous speech or divisive speech, speaking harshly, and then engaging in idle chatter, in gossip. Then the last 3 unwholesome courses of action are purely mental. There's a mind of covetousness, yearning for the possessions of others very strongly. Then the mind of ill will, actively desiring harm and suffering and destruction to come to others. And the last is holding wrong views, especially fixed wrong views which deny the efficacy of moral action. The opposite of these are the 10 courses of wholesome action. That is basically abstaining from these 10 courses and performing the opposite virtues. Avoiding taking of life, one dwells with a compassionate mind. Avoiding stealing, one has an honest mind. Avoiding sexual misconduct, one has a pure mind. One speaks the truth, one speaks what brings harmony to others. One speaks gently and politely to others. One speaks in meaningful and significant ways. Avoiding covetousness, one remains satisfied with what one has. Avoiding ill will, one develops loving kindness, and avoiding wrong views, one holds right views. Those are the 10 courses of wholesome action. Now, karma is so important in Buddhism because our willed actions produce effects. Our willed actions, our karmas, have 2 kinds of effects. One is the immediately visible psychological effect. The other is a special kind of karmic effect. First of all, karma is important because our volitional actions, one by one, determine our characters, our personalities, the total quality of our being. Every willed action that we perform has a certain tendency to repeat itself, to reproduce itself in the future. It's somewhat like a protozoan, like an amoeba. And when the action is performed, then it leaves a track on the mind, an imprint, which can mark the beginning of a new mental tendency. As these actions multiply, then they form our character. Our character, our being, our personality, is nothing really but the sum of all of our willed actions, the kind of cross-section of all our accumulated karma. So by yielding first in simple ways to the unwholesome impulses of the mind,